Welcome to The Study. I'm Craig Robertson, bringing you a program dedicated to the life of the mind. For this program, I travelled to the National Library of Australia in Canberra and met up with Don Mathewson, a radiophysicist and astronomer. Don started in radiophysics and then did his PhD at Jodrell Bank. He returned to Australia and eventually became director of the Mount Stromlo and Siding Spring Observatories and professor of astronomy at the Australian National University. He made a major discovery with the Magellan Extreme at an advanced telescope built at Siding Springs. He did major work on galaxy structures, supernova remnants, and on the structure of the universe.
We had Chums, which is like the boys' own annual. I used to read mainly for pirate stories and Billy Bunter and things of this sort. But they did have a small section on science experiments. That started me actually on the road to experiment, building underground volcanoes and heating up my old toothpaste tubes, which were made of lead in those days, and dropping them from a height because they said that these form spheres and I could use them as my Daisy air gun pellets. Oh, I must have been about seven or eight. I always remember heating up in an old saucepan the toothpaste tubes and pulling them up this old jacaranda tree and then dropping them. It never quite worked out, but then I used to strip the tree guards at school of the wire and paint the wire and try to build an electric motor by winding it around a bit of iron, and that was a dismal failure. And
that's a pretty amazing thing for a kid to try, though, isn't it?
Yeah, I had this dream of building an electric motor when I was eight or so, or nine, and of course it was completely hopeless. In fact, the dream was so strong that when I grew up and had a son, I built an electric motor for him, and I had great pleasure in seeing it work. And of course my mother was a retired teacher, because they all didn't work in those days once they got married, and she was always encouraging me to study, and not that I did much, but I was mainly interested in swimming in the water holes. She, I think, and my father, of course, was an accountant, full of figures, and it was quite a, intellectual sort of upbringing. And I guess it was the war years. I started Brisbane Grammar School in 42, and so it was really all the war years, and it was very dull. The teachers were all old, all the young people had gone. I must say, I didn't enjoy secondary school at all. But I always liked, I did physics and maths. The rest of the subjects I didn't care about. But I always did fairly well at physics and maths. But then it was also post-depression years and money was tight. And so when I finished grammar school, I didn't really have any idea of what I wanted to do in life. But my mother sort of, I guess, sensed that I liked science. We didn't have enough money for me to go to university, so I got a job and went into the pathology laboratory at the Brisbane General Hospital. And there I did all sorts of technical jobs as a young bloke, 18, in the histology department, making up media. This was scientific, and I liked the idea and of experimentation. And then, after 2.5 years, I went into the physics department at the University of Queensland and joined what they call the Radiation Physics Laboratory. And this, I became heavily involved with the Queensland Radium Institute. I was an evening student. I never went to university in the daytime. And it took me 5 years to get the BSc, another 3 years to get honours, an 8-year course just to get honours. But it did me good because I never ever became one of those day university students that had never tasted life. I worked all my way, and money was very important to me. And I guess when I joined, I still wasn't very interested. I did scientific research. I did my Master of Science, because you couldn't do a PhD in those days at Queensland. So I did a Master of Science on beta ray dosimetry. Of course, I used to go up north with the doctors, and we had enormous clinics for skin cancer. Sometimes 200 people we would treat in one day with radon seeds. We'd pump off the gas from radium, put it into little gold seeds, and then I'd make up masks, little plastic dental wax impressions. We'd treat about 100, 200 people a day. There was an epidemic of skin cancer in Queensland. We're talking early 50s.
Epidemic of skin cancer.
And it was an epidemic, absolute epidemic. Yes. People would come in with their foreheads eaten away, with their nose eaten away. It was horrific, actually. But we must have got a lot of body radiation ourselves, because we had a little lead block we used to work behind. The radiation must have come straight down through the wooden table, and we were heating up the radon seeds and putting them into the wax in various geometrical configurations, then strapping it on the patient. It would last for a week. But it never really grabbed me, this work. I just didn't feel completely satisfied. I was a technician. The doctors did all the brain work. Sometimes you'd accompany them into the operating theatres to instruct where to put the radon seeds. They used to implant them in the patient's tongue or wherever. But then a letter arrived from my brother-in-law, who was in the psychology department of the University of Sydney. And he said, oh, I just noticed an advertisement for a research officer at Radiophysics CSIRO in Sydney. They had their headquarters in Sydney University. I thought, oh, why not apply? I just got my honours. And I said, why not apply for it? So I wrote down to Jay Pawsey and sent my references from Hugh Webster, who was the professor of physics. Now, Hugh Webster used to be the head of radiophysics during the wartime years. Anyway, I got a letter inviting me down, and that, I guess, started the magic trip. But I'd already been excited by radio astronomy. As an honour student, I had to do a seminar on the new science, radio astronomy. So I'd read all about Ruby Payne Scott and Bolton and Stanley and Slee discovering this discrete source of radiation. And then, of course, there were the war years. I'd read about Jansky in just 3 years after I was born. He was doing telecommunication work for the Bell Telephone Laboratories. Once again, the famous Bell Telephone Laboratories stepped in. See, it's all about communication, and the same thing happened with the 3-degree Kelvin radiation that was discovered at Bell Telephone. It's by trying to address certain things, like how do you improve radio communication, that they discovered the Milky Way was emitting this great quantity of radio waves. And that was in the early 30s. And then 10 years later, during the war, Great Reba in Illinois, of course, constructed his little dish by an ingenious means and also mapped the sky. And so I'd read all about the work they'd doing at Dover Heights on the top of a cliff, with the clifftop interferometer, the radio waves being reflected off the sea. And then they didn't know where the radio waves were coming from. They didn't know how they originated. They didn't know what were the discrete sources. And it was mystery, this enormous challenge. And this excited me. And so when I went down for the interview, I really wanted to get that job. And I remember, because Brisbane was pretty dead, it was a very backward place, and coming to Sydney for a young bloke, it was exciting. You know, I mean, just getting in the plane was exciting. I went to saw Pup, and here was this tall, gaunt figure with big Latin jaw and sparkly blue eyes behind his spectacles, and very serious. But because I soon discovered that underneath that was a great sense of humour.
Pawsey would have been an important figure for a lot of
scientists. He was very important.
But
they used to hate him coming into their little huts. You know, he had these little huts with all your gear in it, because he'd fiddle, he'd turn knobs. He was a compulsive knob turner. They'd have to reset things after he came in. And so in the end, Frank Kerr, who was working on the 36-footer on the other side of the dam, he even built a special piece of apparatus with lots of knobs on it. And they'd lead Joe over there when he came in the door so he could fiddle these knobs that didn't do anything. And then Pawsey took me for a walk and he said, why are sunspots black? And then it started with a lot of questions like that. And we just walked casually around. And Chris, who joined us for a bit, said, oh, Joe, stop asking all these silly questions. he said, the bloke's just got off a plane. And he said, why, you know, give him a break. And so it went. Anyway, at the end of the day, we went back to radiophysics. He said, oh, come into my office. And so he said, oh, take a seat. And he said, do you want the job? And, God, you know, I didn't think it'd be like that. Do you want the job? And you know, I felt the blood rushing to my face. And I said, oh, yes, you know. And he said, well, you start such and such a few months' time, I think 6 weeks' time. So that was that. And I walked out the door on air, and that was the most exciting day, I think, in my life.
Yeah, that was a real turning point.
Because that was it. That was the...
I understand you would have spent maybe 10 years at Syro Radiophysics then?
Before. Well, I joined in 55, and the 55, 56, 57 were building the crisscross. And they were also magic years because I knew nothing about what I was doing. Nobody knew what we were going to get from the sun.
How much theoretical understanding did you have of what you were doing?
Nothing. Chris had designed the whole thing. Yeah. But I learned how to match impedances and aerials. And I learned as I went. And Chris said to me, he said, look, mate, he said, don't read all those bloody books. He said, just learn about what you're doing. And that's what I did. We didn't know what we were getting with the sun, you know. I mean, well, we knew we'd get spikes at the sunspots. And then a letter arrived, a circulated letter, and it was a letter from Lovell from Jodrell Bank, and it said, we want a young bloke to come over and work. And Taffy was already started on the plans for the big Parkes telescope with Harry Manette over in England already. And he said, look, this is a great opportunity for a young chap to learn how to use a big telescope. And so I wrote back saying, I'd like to apply for this. It was a Levy-Hume Research Fellowship. And anyway, to cut a long story short, I got it. And I said goodbye to the sun and Fleurs, my home, and the old hut, and all the fun of the Mills Cross lying alongside, and Alex Shane's cross, and Max Komisaroff walking down the line with a big Shanghai to fight off the magpies. And all of that was gone, and I was on my way in a super constellation.
This 250-footer telescope sounds like a big one.
It was the biggest in those days. Well, it almost still is. There aren't too many bigger single dishes. It was a completely different atmosphere to radio physics. Everybody was introvert. There was no... You couldn't outgo. You couldn't laugh a lot. There was a very strict status ranking. I was an outsider. I interviewed Lovell. I made a joke. I said, Jesus, there are icicles on the hut. I said, not much heating. And he said, Mathewson, he said, see that caravan outside? I worked there for years. And do you know what I did to keep warm, Mathewson? Jump up and down. And he said, that is my advice to you. Jump up and down. And I thought, oh, God. You know. And he said, anyway, Pawsey had said...
How old would Lovell have been then?
Oh, geez, 45, something like that. Yeah. He loved being Lovell. He loved being a big man. And
did he have any real research achievements?
Meteor astronomy, but really very, very not a big scientific name, but he knew how to work the network. He got this 250-foot telescope built, which was a great achievement, really wonderful. You know, top marks. They'd already built a similar size telescope, just attached to the ground, and then they steered it by swinging the feed, and that. But of course, this was a fully steerable radar telescope, and of course, then the space era. See, Sputnik had just gone up, and the world was coming alive with space. And of course, Jodrell Bank just slotted in. The Americans wanted to use it. The Russians wanted to use it. And there were long booths, telephone booths, set up outside, not inside the control building, with open lines to Russia, open lines, and Lovell would sweep up in his Jag, his old Jag, battered old blue Jag, and he'd hop out, and he'd always have his right profile turned to the cameras, because there were masses of cameramen, and JPL Studios had set up a caravan. He'd sweep in with his black homburg, his hat, and his cape, black cape, sweep into the control room, and they'd be clicking away, and oh, he was in his element, absolute element. I mean, I always remember he took over half my night that I'd allocated. It was very difficult getting time on the 250-footer to record, to be the first man to have his voice bounced off the moon. And he had to have it for the 8 o'clock BBC session. They'd had an agreement. He took over the whole, my telescope and the feed and the front end. And he had this back end the set up, and he would sit on a little stool. And I always remember this. He was bald, graying, and he was saying, "Hello, moon! Hello, moon!" So anyway, I managed to get into the, you could get into the swing laboratory, even though the dish was at that particular declination. And so I quietly opened the door, and he was this little figure with his back to me, sitting on top of a power supply saying, "Hello, moon! Hello, moon!" So I waited a couple of seconds and I said, "Hello, moon!" And he turned around and he said, "Matthewson," he said, "sometimes you annoy me." And I went out, and he finally got the propagation characteristics changed. He didn't twiddle anything, didn't improve the noise of the receiver, but the propagation characteristics changed, and he got his echo. And sure enough, the 8 o'clock BBC News had Al Lovell saying, "Hello, moon." And "Hello, moon" came back. So,
but it wasn't your voice.
No, it wasn't my voice.
Probably the main thing here now is that you did your PhD.
Yeah, that was Joe Pawsey in Paris. He said to me, "Look, Matthewson," he said, "this Levy Hume Fellowship is for 3 years." He said, "Why don't you do your PhD?" Because you see, you couldn't do PhDs in Australia. Or we could just, in Sydney, you just started.
Just a few of them.
And I said, "Oh, fine." Jodrell Bank's attached to the University of Manchester, you see. So Hanbury Bower is my supervisor, except I never saw Hanbury in a supervision role to the day I handed in the thesis. And so we just went about with Michael Large and Glenn Haslam. We had a little group, and we would observe. And so I did the thesis, which was the best thing I ever did. You need a PhD.
What was it on?
It was on studies of various objects with the 250-foot paraboloid. And it was the Cygnus Loop, Andromeda Nebula, and the Cygnus X region. And I did it on these three, and also the calibration of the dish. But, of course, during the thing, I wanted to do some polarisation measurements, and I organised a big tape and the workshop to help me to measure the parameters of the 250-footer. I was on my way over. He walked over to the lift to go up, and Lovell saw me, and he said, "What's that tape for?" And I said, "Oh, I'm just measuring the dish. I want to do polarisation measurements." He said, "Never." He said, "You will not take that tape on the dish." Well, I thought, I want it, because So I said, "Oh, okay." Anyway, I went up there, and our Fred Smith, the technician, came with me, and we got the tape out. And of course, the dish was 3 foot longer in one cross section to the one perpendicular to it. It had sagged about the elevation towers. It was completely. He should never have accepted that dish, in an engineering sense, from the builder. It was Hubbard. It was way out of spec, and I suddenly realised why he forbade me to take the tape on.
He didn't want you to see it.
I knew I couldn't do polarisation measurements, so I didn't care. I didn't say anything to him. Well, obviously, I would have got tossed out. But I knew that the dish just didn't meet specifications. But that was Lovell all over. He knew he couldn't, because he'd got the money from the National Geographic and God knows where else, the Royal Society.
Well, presumably that became known eventually.
Eventually it did, but it was much later on, and I don't know, it was so late, so much later on that they didn't care about it. And also they recovered the dish, and I think they've corrected a lot of it.
Don returned to Australia and found big changes underway at CSIRO Radiophysics. He was close to Joe Pawsey until Pawsey's death from a brain tumour, but a difficult relationship with John Bolton, the first director of the new Parkes Radio Telescope, led to his applying for a job at Mount Stromlo. Before taking up the position, he spent some time working in the US and at Leiden in the Netherlands.
And then I came back to Australia. Then I went straight to Stromlo. And that was, I think it was the best move I've made in my life, going to Stromlo at that time.
In one of the books I read, it says that you're one of the first to cross this radio-optical divide, and you have, I think, already made some reference to healing rifts there.
Yeah, there was big rifts developed.
How did you go about that, or was that something later on when you...
Well, it was later on.
Radio and optical, in a sense, just different techniques of exploring the universe.
And they didn't know,
I suppose,
too much, yeah.
How did you see the whole issue? Was it just a technical problem gone wrong because of two different groups? I mean, there seemed to be a certain amount of institutional dysfunction from what I'm reading in the...
Oh, enormous amount. I never was much interested in politics. And to be truthful, I only cared about the science. I was always looking at my project. I was very focused. It was a funny business because my lifespan really bridged, you know, the start of radio astronomy. And I did a bit of integration because I discovered the radio supernova remnant. Then I needed Westerland to do the optical. So I was already integrating the two. And I suddenly, and I realised, of course, the discrete sources, you know, the Crab Nebula that Bolton had, and the Large Magellanic Cloud that I'd surveyed, that you needed so much. The optical was the key. The radio, to me, was always like a signpost saying, there's something really great there, but that's as far as it could go. The radio could never move away, could never interpret what it was, and the physics of what it was. It was a signpost. And the optical would then follow the radio, but then the optical would solve or go much further in the physics of the thing. You see, quasars had come. It was a wonderful era, really. The quasars hit, and of course Bolton was all over quasars, and the radio telescope, you know, I'd be digging the hole so the dish could tilt down further. And then, of course, quickly after the quasars came the pulsars. This showed me how astronomers are so... Really, it's a personality, it's an ego thing, because those pulsars were discovered by that student, of course, you know, Bell, and Hewish was a supervisor, and they were shielded. You'd go into the room at Cambridge, and there'd be the great shuffling of papers and drawers slamming, and they didn't want anybody to know about the discovery. And it was only months that they let it out about the little green men and all that. So it's not a case of you discover something and you say blab it away. Everybody shields it because it's an ego massage. You see, it's not just the science. You're not just a pure little scientist saying, oh, isn't this physics wonderful? Oh, this is lovely. There's an ego trip with every scientific experiment.
There were too many large projects in Don's career to cover in detail, but I did ask him about some of them.
All the projects are really exciting, but the Magellanic Stream, because it came quickly and yet slowly, I was sitting, I remember, in the library at Stromlo, and I read this paper by Wanier and Rickson, and they'd come across this, right up the north sky, this a stream of hydrogen gas. They attributed, I don't know why they did it, but to a star, a nearby star, something expelled from it. And I couldn't work that one out. But it's in the Astrophysical Journal. But I thought, gee, that streak. And now I was just fiddling around, and I thought, I wonder what happens if you just extrapolate this. And of course it was so far in the north that it was a big extrapolation. But it headed into the clouds. And of course, you get so many dead ends. I just laughed, I just thought. But this little strip, they'd had a sinusoid variation in velocity. So just for the fun of it, I just extrapolated the sinusoid all the way along. And blow, suddenly the velocity of the sinusoid was the velocity of the strip, of the Magellanic Cloud. And I thought, God, you know, and it just, your little thing gets into your chest. Not only does it spatially extrapolate to there, but velocity-wise it does. And so I phoned up Brian Robinson at Radio Physics, who was the director of research in those days. And I said, look, Brian, I really need to use the 250, the 210-footer Parkes. And he said, you've got to apply for time. And I said, look, I've really got something. And he said, well, they're going up to test the new correlator on the hydrogen receiver. If the engineers don't mind, you can have an hour or a couple of hours. So I said, I'll do it. So I had a young student, a vocation scholar, Adele Butler. She's very curvaceous, and she was from Melbourne. So we got in the car, drove up, arrived there in the afternoon. The engineer said, well, you know, they don't like astronomers. They said, now keep out, we really want you out. And I said, well, can I come and just watch? And they said, all right, but just watch, that's all, because we've heard your reputation. You always push yourself in everywhere. So Brian Cooper was there, because he was a bit of a friend. Anyway, Adele Butler came, and she took off her coat, and she was wearing a see-through blouse. I goggled, and all the engineers, well, you know what engineers are like, but it was the days of the see-through. Anyway, I thought, by God. Anyway, they went about their business. Midnight came, and of course I was itching, and of course the thing wasn't working. The correlator didn't work. And I thought, well, I'm shot, absolutely shot to pieces. And they said, well, look, the best we can do is we can bring the reference frequency very close to your observational frequency, but you'll get an S-curve if you get a detection. And I said, oh, that's okay, I can work with that. And then they all went off because it was they were tired. They'd been working all day when I had the dish to myself. And so I had 20 points picked out along this extrapolated line. And I had frequencies against each point, and you should get a signal. And anyway, every point I pointed to, I got a signal at the right frequency, even with this terrible receiver. And as I went, you know, one, two, three, you sort of discount, you say, oh, no, you know, it's just luck, there's something there. But after about 10, now, you know, I just was so much beside myself. And, of course, Adele had gone back because it was 2 or 3 in the morning. The controller, who was one of the Parks people, just went had gone to sleep with the Playboy magazine across his chest because they all read Playboy. So I had to set the dish, lean over him and set the dish myself. And
push yourself.
And in. I was all by myself, really, because everybody had gone apart from the sleep controller. It was getting very near daybreak, and I thought, oh, God, those engineers are going to get up, you know, very early. And I was watching for the car heading down. You could see the road they'd come from the quarters. And I was saying, now you just got to keep, you know. Anyway, I got the last observation in, and the car came down. And there I knew I had it, just in that, one, you know, 3 hours. And I knew it was there. And then I thought, but who's going to believe me? I haven't surveyed any part of the sky. I don't know what it looks like. There's just a signal. It could be anything. So then I looked across at the old 60-footer that I'd used at Fleurs and that had been taken to Parks, and I thought we'd just have to do the whole sky survey with that. And so I then got John Murray put a receiver on the 60-footer for me, and we had a little control console set up, and a student joined me, Martha Cleary from Stromlo. She was a 23-year-old Irish woman, a real Irish woman, red hair, and took no nonsense from anybody. And she helped with the observations. And John Murray did, he'd done the receiver. So we ground out 6 months, and there it was, that lovely stream. And then, of course, just by luck, there was a big IAU symposium at Stromlo and Maroochydore in the Academy of Science. And in the Academy of Science in Canberra, I presented. As Egan said to me later, he said, you blew everybody's mind. And it was really quite, because in those days the tails were starting to appear on interacting galaxies, and of course we never knew that the cloud was starting to interact.
Look, I think astronomy probably illustrates this better than any other sciences, this is playoff between observation and theory.
The thing is, with radio astronomy, it was always three things. It was resolution was a big battle, because radio waves are so big. Once you got resolution, you started to discover interesting things. And that meant size, but then, of course, came the beautiful aperture synthesis technique where you could simulate an enormous-sized dish just with a few little dishes. That was first developed by Christensen at Potts Hill, and then, of course, the Cambridge group. See, you needed computers. You needed absolute computers, and they, of course, had it, and we didn't. Celiac was our first computer. So, and you needed sensitivity. Now, all the new receivers were coming up with, you know, the Japanese and the Americans, Bell Telephone, all those new fancy devices, the mazes and so on. And then you needed broad scale, you needed more than a point source detector, you needed a panoramic detector, and of course there came the CCDs. These are the things...
CCD.
Well, the charge coupled device. Okay. That was also in astronomy, but you needed it in the radio as well as in the optical, and of course you needed the big dishes in the optical. You know, you had these enormous dishes in Hawaii. Those were the triumph. Once you got these things, both in radio and optical, you then cracked things just automatically. It was like, you imagine if you had very bad eyesight, say a big cataract or something, and everything was a blur around this room, and then all of a sudden the person did an operation and put in a lens, and suddenly you wake up and you saw what we're seeing now. You imagine, that's what astronomy was about. the sky was just a blur. You didn't have the, you couldn't get much distance, you couldn't get much resolution, it was all fuzzy and blurry. You had faint, tiny little signals coming that were right down in the noise. Well, once you started getting the resolution and the sensitivity and the panoramic, so you could look at large areas, and also the analyze large areas, and then the computers to do all this job, then you broke open astronomy. And it was as simple as that. The quasars came from that. The pulsars, the identification of where the pulsars came from. I know they came from the scintillations, but you had to find out what they were. The pulsars came from that, the optical pulsars, the black holes, those fantastic things that now they know that the centre of practically every galaxy came from that. And then, of course, you went on to all these fancy things like the large-scale structure of the 3-degree Kelvin came from getting techniques, sensitivity techniques. And then, of course, you had the accelerating universe. You had all these wonderful, wonderful discoveries, but purely due to these basic factors. So you didn't need to dream up a theory and say, in particular, and say, look, we have to look for a black hole, we have to look for a pulsar, we have to look... You had to have just the basic ingredients, right? And then they all fell into your lap.
You're listening to The Study, and we're talking to Don Mathewson, radiophysicist and astronomer. In the late 1970s, Don became director of the Mount Stromlo and Siding Springs Observatories. There were more large projects, but Don was also an energetic and innovative administrator.
Then there were the state universities that were starting to come up, you know, University of Sydney, Monash, Melbourne, Perth, Tasmania, Hobart, and it needed bridges being built there. We did that by inviting them to observe on our on the ANU's telescopes. And then we had the student summer school. The students went from 3 to 30 in several years when I started directorship, because I could see that was the lifeblood.
I was going to ask you about this, yeah.
It was an enormous increase. I mean, generally we'd have one or two students. And the staff even complained. They said, God, we've got more students than staff. He said, this was completely a revolution. But I said, if you want to keep astronomy going, I said, you've got to do this.
Then what sort of projects would they have been working on then?
Good projects. I had supervising several. And because, you see, you had so much to do, and the computers were coming in, things were becoming, you know, one night on the AAT could take you 2 years to analyse. I mean, you reduced the data on the computers, but then you had all the figures. But boy, to work, to get something out of that, a student could work for a couple of nights on the AAT or on the 40-inch or eventually when we built the 2.3-metre, and they could go off and get their thesis out of it. So it's not a case of designing. You are as good as your telescope, a scientist. All projects could never, ever have been achieved without technology. There are theoreticians that are wonderful. You know, I mean the big fellows, they do predict, like the 3-degree Kelvin, they predicted that. The local magnetic field was wonderful. That still, I think it's so referenced so many times, they call it a classic. But see, once again, I couldn't have done that without the... I walked into Stromlo, and they just erected the rotating 24-inch telescope. Now, rotating means it can do polarisation measurements, because you observe the radiation one direction, then rotate it. And that gives you the polarisation, which is then, of course, according gives you the magnetic field direction. I sweated at that telescope for about nearly a year and a half, 2 years. Did a full sky survey as far as you can see from the southern sky, and showed this fantastic pattern in the magnetic field. It was a lot of observing, but it was never a grind. When you know what you're getting, when you know this pattern is emerging, like doing a photographic film, you know, developing it and seeing the image come up. So that was a lot of fun.
You seem to like large projects that take a period of years to...
Well, you know, you can't do too much. You can do even the Magellanic Stream. I mean, you might get the lead in one night, but all good projects, I mean, the 3-degree Kelvin radiation, the quasars, the pulsars, Sure, you get the lead in one night, and that's exciting, but you've got to do the sky survey. You've got to do the hard work. But it never is hard work. You never say to yourself, oh, God. Because you know what you're going for, and you're seeing little glimpses of it coming out as the months roll on. The only time it's not exciting, and this shows you how ego comes into it, is if some bloke comes up and says, oh, Don, I really want you to do this little job for me while you're at the telescope. And you have to spend 2 hours doing this fellow who pleaded with you to do his little bit of research. And that is boring. You've got to do it. You've got to calibrate perfectly. You've got to all your time, your own galaxy or whatever it is fleeting away. You're kind enough, because he cried practically in your arms, to do this work for him. And that is the most boring time I ever spend at telescopes, is doing somebody else's work. But as soon as it switches to your work, oh, wacko, you know, you're alive. And it's so much personalities in science. And the other work, oh, the Magellanic Cloud, the split, all of that's fantastic, you know, the split in the SMC, the small cloud to the intercloud region, and the Great Attractor. That was probably the biggest project, in a way. I know I went over to Israel, to a university in Jerusalem, and worked there for a bit, Bernstein and Dressler and so on, and they really hated me, because I did much more. I could do much more survey work than they could do, and I found out that, sure, they weren't wrong in what they did, but they'd done too little, and when you went out further, there was no sign of the Great Attractor at this particular distance. There was no sign of the galaxies falling back in on the other side. See, they got the galaxies falling towards the Great Attractor, but if you went out further, you should get them coming back, and you never did. They just kept on going out. There was the Heron Island workshop, which was, they said, Peter Quinn organised for my 65th birthday, and a great crowd of them came out to Heron Island and had a wonderful time. And I think they finally got convinced there, and amongst the snorkelling along the reefs. They had most of the top people there.
I've got a couple of other things I'd like to chuck in at this point. One is, I'm curious as to how important mathematics is in your work.
Oh, well, you've got a certain level of maths. I mean, obviously, you know, there's an arithmetic level, but you've got the deeper maths, and that's the tree. Mathematics is the tree, and then the branches go out to other fields. And without maths, you'd have nothing, basically. Nothing to hang things on, nothing to predict, nothing to analyse, nothing to say, oh boy, it's synchrotron radiation. Or you've got to have the fundamental of all of science, no matter whether in medicine or anything, is mathematics. I mean, you try doing science without maths, you couldn't build anything. The theories of the universe, which are absolutely fascinating.
Having mentioned theories of the universe, how do you think that's changed over the period of your life?
Oh, it's been enormous, really. I mean, the Big Bang, people like to attribute to the origin of the universe, but it's not the origin of the universe. The Big Bang is the development of the universe from early time. It's really the development. It gives you the origin of the elements, the origin of the large-scale structure, the 3-degree Kelvin, you know, and so on. But nobody knows the origin of the universe. You get a cold from the waving of hands, you know. I mean, Stephen Hawking doesn't know. Although I don't think his impact on science has been tremendous as other people. I think he's got a big name. But really, the origin, I mean, they talk about the, you know, quantum, and you get universes bubbled up and dry, and then suddenly one takes off, and then you get inflation and so on. If you read the literature from good people, they all say the origin is unknown. But then you have your Big Bang, which is great for the development. It really is a nice way of getting galaxies formed and elements formed and so forth, and radiation interaction. Then, of course, you know, once the galaxies have time to form, so the accelerating universe couldn't have come in then, you then get the accelerating universe and so on. Adam Riess was really the one with the accelerating universe. And also there were two teams developed, and I think they both submitted papers on May the 15th, 1998, one in the Atterbury's in the Astronomical Journal and Brian in the Astrophysical. Their names appear on the author. See, one thing about authorships, that's another big change in astronomy. In my day, you either had one author, two authors, at the most, even three was pushing it. Now there are 50 authors quite commonly, certainly 20, 30. And it's changed, you see. You've got these enormous facilities. You've got the Hubble Space Telescope. You've got these giant telescopes, the Magellan, up, you know, and you in Chile and also on Mauna Kea. The big arrays, you know, radio arrays. You've got to have a lot of countries involved. It's too, you know, billions of dollars you're talking about in operation and so on. And you've got to have the big, and to do that, you've got to have different observatories involved. And to do that, you've got to have names from different observatories in, because otherwise the observatories aren't going to spend money supporting that staff. The whole game is completely depersonalized. You've got a figurehead, you might say Brian Schmidt, but who cares? The most important thing is that they have indications that the universe is accelerating. Not that the galaxies are accelerating, it's the space that moves. The space expands and the galaxies, of course. The galaxies aren't getting shot out. It's the space between the galaxies. The thing is that the dark energy, of course, came.
Well, I was going to ask if you care to sort of look ahead. Do you think like something like dark matter is going to, like, is the picture going to change radically, do you think, in the foreseeable future? Or?
Well, it certainly is going to change radically. I'm not a pundit, you know, I mean, and I'm not deeply involved now.
There seems to be a lot more talk about dark matter, energy.
Oh, dark energy, 73%.
Yes, I went to a lecture about this, so I hadn't really, just a year or two ago, and I wasn't really aware of the sort of depth of this problem, but
it's
getting a lot more attention, I think, now, isn't it? So you tend to expect that maybe something's going to come out of it.
Oh, yeah, the 73% dark energy, whatever that is, and then there's so much dark matter, cold dark matter, and then 4% or something visible.
Of what we can see.
But something, you see, the trouble is with the world is that astronomy is not publicised. People aren't familiar with astronomy. And yet it's the most exciting thing that's happening to the world today. I mean, you turn on the news, you'll hear about the pain at the pump, you know. We're missing the whole point of living. The whole point of living is not these petty, about your mortgage, about your... We're too worried about whether we got some palatial home, which will be home for two people, or whether we drive, you know, a 10-foot Jaguar or a bicycle. We're missing the whole point. We've been created, I think, with a purpose. I think, you know, the universe is a complex thing. And I'm not talking about God here, but I'm talking about the universe. The universe, we're not just accidentally here. I know you have the anthropic principle in which things are as they are because, you know, we're here. I mean, things just have to support our development. So let's not worry about that. Let's not worry that there are at least 10 physical constants that are so finely tuned that if they were differed by it.
This is my big ideas part of it. I mean, this is a sort of thing that Paul Davies is...
Yeah, well, Paul Davies, of course.
...publicised the idea that maybe life is endemic in the universe because these constants are set the way they are. I mean, what's your
absolutely.
Take on all that?
Paul Davies is quite correct. The thing, and Hoyle, who was quite a friend of mine, actually, we had many, many talks. The thing is that they're just discovering in space that meteorites have, you know, chemicals to make RNA and DNA. I think a meteorite discovered in Australia, just recently they've done it. The thing is that interstellar matter is flooded with very sort of things that can turn into bacteria or are bacteria. They can certainly withstand the temperatures and radiation levels out there. It just didn't occur in a muddy puddle on Earth. Sure, the conditions were great, you know, all water and all the rest of it, and the distance from the sun. But the thing is that the whole of the galaxy is flooded with this very simple bacteria. It's with a purpose.
When you say it's a bacteria, how do you...
Well, it's a bacteria. I'm thinking a
bacterium to me is something that can self-replicate, for one thing.
Well, I don't know whether it can self-replicate. I'm not a biologist, and I really don't know. But I think if to have it come from lightning, from thunderstorms, and with the certain elements that are available on Earth, Hoyle worked out that it was more unlikely to happen in a muddy puddle than if you gave a blind man a Rubik cube and asked him to solve it. You know, I mean, the odds were horrendous. But the fundamental form, whatever that may be, and I don't know what it is, but the real starter, the real kick along, the fundamental to form bacteria is there. Now, I don't know what form that would be. I don't know. But I've got a feeling that it's already there in comets, in meteorites, in interstellar space. The comets could even transport it inside. That they could be the messengers, the little carriers of the bacteria. And I think, see, life can be many forms as we look out the window. You know, there's birds, bees, men, and so forth. I guess life could take, even from this, many forms. But I think it's very likely to be in our form because we're quite efficient. The brain, well up high and preserved.
Do you think a sense of beauty has informed your work?
Oh, yes, I think beauty is...
Well, you can have beauty in mathematics,
you can have beauty in science. Yes. It's a very beautiful subject. Just the feeling, I mean, well, there are certain things, I guess, like looking at art exhibitions. To me, looking at the Parkes Radio Telescope, it makes me...
It's an object of
full
beauty.
Of awe, yes. as an object. I've walked down the path, I see these orthogonal, crisscrossing orthogonal structures. The 2.3 telescope, you can walk up, if you've got a long exposure, you walk up the staircase at the back and you walk along that little walkway and you see a little edge of the mirror looking and you feel all the photons are plopping in, you know, in there and getting counted. And what a thrill they must feel rather than plopping out on a bit of cow dung after travelling for billions of years. And you look at the arc of the Milky Way, or sometimes you're fortunate enough to see a little bit of aurora. It really brings you close to what you're doing because you feel as if you're part of the universe. See, in my everyday life, you don't feel you're part of the universe. You know, you lose complete perspective. You're not on this little bit of spinning rock and you're not part of the expansion and so on. I think one of the terrible things is that man doesn't realise his place. He's so intent upon selling a home for a big profit or doing a business or selling wheat or oil or something. And I would say 99% of human beings are missing on what wonderful creatures they are. Each of us is superb, superb products, and yet we spend most of our time wasting it. Absolutely wasting it on silly wars and the starvations that are going on. You want to weep because it's a waste of time. Man should be utilised. And I believe we were created. I wouldn't mind betting that the whole shebang, that we are the end product of the whole exercise.
And I do think people do have in the back of their mind, and amongst all that busyness, do have a genuine interest in it.
Yes.
And it is because, you know, they tend to see some sort of deeper meaning in what's being discovered.
Yeah, I think the worst thing that ever happened, and not the worst thing, but I think religion has been absolutely misused. And I've got no qualms with the concept of Jesus. I mean, obviously he was a great philosopher, and that's great. And God, who knows? I mean, God is a good word to use for an astronomer because I think there is some intelligence. It's an intelligent universe. I don't know how that intelligence actually, you know, comes. But we are, I think, the end products. And therefore, that we've got a lot to do, you know. And it's almost as if the universe wants us to analyse itself.
Well, I was going to say that your work seems to have given you a tremendous amount of happiness and personal fulfilment.
You're very lucky. I guess every time will be great, but to me, the times in astronomy, you know, going right back from the soul of work with Christensen, and then all through the Jodrell Bank and all the exciting discoveries and the opportunities I've had, particularly in Leiden Observatory, which was great, and Parkes and Siding Spring, and then of course visiting, becoming the nomad, visiting the Canary Islands and the Hawaiian Islands and going up into the mountains of Chile. You know, in the early days, there were only a few hundred practicing astronomers, and it was like a club. People invited you into a home, you slept there for a couple of days, you know. So it was just like a club, and even though now it's expanded enormously and there's probably 5,000 practicing astronomers, it's still a very small club, very small, but it's so fortunate. I mean, you know, you can go up into the Andes, and it's rugged getting there, you know, and a car driven by a Spaniard with chasms on either side, or up in the Italian Alps, or in Moscow, you know. But suddenly, they invite you to dinner, the Russians, and everything disappears. There's no such thing as talking about politics or wars, or you immediately talk about your astronomy, and no matter what the politics are between your countries, you are an astronomer, and that is all that matters. I mean, they always have opinions, but they're really interested in their work, and that's the beauty. It's truly international in a really, you know, deep and true sense.
Can I just ask, your family and personal life, has that had any sort of great impact on your professional life, or seem to have had good support?
Well, my wife is a GP, and so she, you know, she actually worked for me at Radiophysics during her vacation, and then you have a couple of kids. But the big thing is that I spent an enormous amount of time away, Siding Spring and overseas. This, in some ways, in my personal life, is I regret. Luckily, we had my wife is a Russian, and the mother is a very, you know, true blue Russian, and she spent weeks with the children while they were growing up, and she was a very good nanny, Russian, discipline, but cooking was fantastic, and she was a fair woman, and I really owe an awful lot to her, because without that, I think my children might have been neglected. But when I was home, because we always lived up at Stromlo Observatory, and they were very close, my home was always close, they used to often, you know, come up if they wanted something. And so living at the observatory meant I could give them a lot of time. I had no travel or anything. And when I lived in the director's residence, they loved that. And I keep in contact by reading. But basically, I've developed a great passion for flying. You've got to have passions in your life, and astronomy was my passion, and that really is a nice spin-off. And I just hope I can keep on flying.
That sounds like a good place to end, a good sentiment to end on, I think, Don. Unless there's anything else you'd like to add to the record?
Yeah, it's just been a lot of fun, a lot of excitement. I guess the message I would like to give to my grandchildren is to be interested in astronomy, and the message I'd like to give to the world is astronomy will excite you more than it's like something you don't know about and something you're not familiar with, you shy away from, and that's what people do with astronomy. They say, oh no, it's too hard, it takes a bit, you know, all that maths, no, we can't look at... But if they really just picked up and read something, they would suddenly find a great excitement in their life, and they wouldn't worry so much about all the trivial things.
If you've listened to these podcasts at all or looked over the website, you'll know my idea of the study, is all about making a space where someone can undertake a whole range of activity, scholarly, creative, focused activity that needs concentration for lengthy periods. It's a sort of place where you can work without the world bumping your elbow every time you move. It's a sort of program for people who like to withdraw at least for a while from the hurly-burly and find their way into an inner life, or to construct an inner life where the mind is freer. Sometimes I feel like there is a conspiracy to eliminate the kind of quietness needed, especially from the public domain. It comes from commercial interests, of course, but there is also a certain cultural outlook that can't bear to have it in galleries or museums or even libraries, that willingly disrupts it with technology and any kind of distraction. People take mobile calls in the reading rooms and among the book stacks without a care. What I'm after is the kind of space that the great crime writer Raymond Chandler once talked about. Chandler, a major creator of the American hard-bitten private eye, was English. He was educated in an old grammar school environment where the boys were, in effect, detained in quiet rooms with their books for hours, with strict controls on fooling around. He imposed the same habits on himself throughout his writing career, shutting himself up alone, his wife staunchly defending his privacy. Just like in his schoolboy situation, he was not compelled to do anything. The idea was that, out of boredom if nothing else, some work would get done. The boys would study their books. Chandler wrote his tough, highly crafted prose that did so much to spawn a literary genre that has sustained a publishing industry ever since. Astronomers, of course, have their own problems making a space to work and finding locations free of the light and dust pollution thrown in their way. They have to go to remote mountaintops. They have to keep strange hours. Don Mathewson tells me that he would normally do a 13-hour stint overnight, most times alone, often in the freezing cold. There's been more written about the fear of being alone, indeed the pathology of it, than the capacity for it, than about its rewards. I think there's something very appealing about being cloistered for long hours with the stars, exploring the edge of the known universe. It has a sort of romantic attraction, but I'd be the first to admit that I could never have taken on the long overnight hours that Don did. The nearest I ever got to it was spending my summers in student days as a fire watcher. But I did spend long periods alone in the bush when I was writing too. It's not something that appeals to me now. A few days camping is usually enough. The setup in a quiet room is more productive. I'm not sure how much my dear wife understands these habits, but at least when I'm doing it, I guess she knows where I am and generally keeping out of trouble. One thing I know is that I've never had to rely on boredom to make me work. Don assures me that he was never bored, never got tired, quite the contrary, that the adrenaline would be pumping because he was always on the hunt. There was always a goal beckoning. A single passing cloud could be aggravating. One time at Jodrell Bank in his youth, he was awake for 72 hours. He remembers the passion that drove him to do it. Over the years, observing gradually change from looking through small self-built instruments to big computerized ones with display screens. Well, I hope that passion is still possible. My hat is off to all the real astronomers out there that do that. They, and I certainly include all the amateurs that dedicate themselves to this, are people who deserve support. I'm sure you can find a local astronomical society almost anywhere. They may well spot that asteroid coming and help save us, for one. That's something that has only become widely understood in recent times. But aside from standing lookout on the city wall, they also keep open a door on the mysteries of the world. They keep our little planet tuned in and open for things, not just by playing with gadgets, but by concentrating. Music in this program included our two regular themes, the Handel Suite played by Elizabeth Anderson and the Bach Prelude played by Ronald Varon Price, both recorded on Move Records. Full details are on the study website at www.thestudy.net.au. And so, until next time, it's shut the door and reading lamp only in the study.